lots of chances before.
Flights 175 and flight 11 were faked, no planes crashed into the World Trade Center on 9/11, if this conclusion is not compatible with any listeners tonight, then I can only implore that you should listen to our previous 9/11 specials for a breakdown of the how and the why, and particularly of the evidence. I mean, some of which we will be getting into tonight, but this issue tonight will more be discussing the how and the why as opposed to the what particularly was done, though that will come up. Now, in September of 2012, Brian and Justin had Jim on their show. It was an interesting exchange, to say the least. It was certainly refreshing to hear him agree with us on the fact that all four crash sites on 9/11, alleged crash sites, were fake, because we really weren't sure exactly what to expect having Jim on the show. I mean, he's been around a long time, and he certainly flip-flopped on a lot of issues. But I mean, I think we all have, everybody who's been in the movement, you know, 10, 15 years or longer. I mean, between 5 and 10 years, we've flip-flopped, and you can't really hold that against anyone, myself certainly. There's just so much disinformation. Now, the first hour of this first interview was a great exchange. I mean, Fetzer articulates his points magnificently, it must be said, about Flight 175 and its impossible penetration and flight into the tower. And he's very well spoken, aside from perhaps going down the JFK road early on. It really was a great interview up to that point, and certainly past that point too. But, you know, the interview started to get challenging when Brian and Justin questioned some elements of the eyewitness testimony, particularly Scott Forbes, who Jim seems to have quite an affinity for. Soon after this point, you know, I felt motivated to actually call into the show myself to challenge Fetzer on some of these issues. And in fact, for your convenience, we're going to hear some brief excerpts of that show now. And Jim's, what could only be described as defense of Scott Forbes, which really struck me as a little bizarre, but he had him on a show, and he certainly had an affinity for what he said. So, and Jim seemed genuine. So, you know, we're going to listen to now a small excerpt of my call into that show, and we'll talk about it a little bit when we get back.
You can stay in the line for a little bit, and that's a little more after. We have another call that wants to get through, and we're gonna throw him on the air now too. We had a couple questions for Jim as well. Jim, that's cool with you, right?
Of course. Yeah, sure.
James Sloan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What would you like to ask Jim Fetzer or Justin Cook or myself tonight?
Well, first of all, I was listening to the show, and I was listening, Jim, to your interview with Scott Forbes. I believe it was, I think, 2 years ago now. I remember on your radio show. Is that right?
Who are you talking about?
Scott Forbes interview.
You listened to the Scott Forbes interview? I thought you were mentioning somebody else. I mean, I've got 500 interviews there on the archives, okay? 500 two-hour interviews, so, you know.
Yeah. Sorry, the Scott Forbes one you did, I think it was 2 years ago.
You listened to the Scott Forbes, yeah. Okay, tell me about it.
Well, I mean, yeah, I listened to the interview. He certainly seemed like a legit guy and everything like that. But, you know, I mean, I can't say for him personally, but, you know, I've done some looking online, and you know, there have actually been a number of people that have posted up tickets, you know, to the observation deck that actually visited the observation deck the day that he claimed, or the weekend that he claims the power down was in place. And also, yeah, we have a music video from Ryan Adams called New York, New York, which was shot on the same day, actually, and throughout the night on that weekend. And it shows the Trade Center relatively well lit up on the South Tower. And as well as some other things, it seems to be problems with his tail. I mean, like, because if there was a power down, I guess the inference is that there would be explosives placed during that time or some sort of fine-tuning done. But how would they do that in the dark? Because if the power's out, I mean, it's a bit far-fetched to think that they went around placing explosives in the dark. And furthermore to that, we're told that, you know, 50,000 people visited those observation decks every day and the complex. So, I mean, how would you shut all those people up over a weekend? You'd have like 100,000 people that they would have had to turn away.
Well, personally, I don't have any reason to suppose it was being done the way you're describing and all this business in the dark. I mean, who the hell knows? I mean, he was talking about, I don't know if the power outage was on a Friday, as I recall. I'd have to go back and really listen to the interview. But I didn't find anything implausible about what he had to say. I didn't find anything doubtful. He seemed to me perfectly sincere. I have dealt with one hell of a lot of men in my life. I went to an all-male college as an undergraduate at Princeton. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. I taught thousands of students over 35 years. I have got a pretty good sense of telling when somebody is coming across as truthful or not. He came across to me as truthful. Now, if he comes across to you as not truthful, well, that's all right with me, because, you know, I can't transfer my experience to you, nor you to me, and we all have to make those judgments for ourselves. I'm saying, based upon the evidence available to me, and I've gone out of my way to accumulate it or try to accumulate it, he seemed to me to be perfectly bona fide. Maybe I'm wrong, but he seemed perfectly bona fide. But the point is, it doesn't all just hinge on Scott Forbes, because as I said, you got this whole host of additional radar data that that Richard Hall unearthed, which shows a plane that's flying parallel to the track of the plane seen in the videos, where that plane is not seen in the radar data because as a hologram, it's not going to show up. But a physical plane in the air is going to show up, and it's 1,400 feet to the right of the image that you see in the videos. I mean, I really think this is a brilliant piece of work. So I recommend it to you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's just, of course it's not Scott Forbes, but if
you can take Scott Forbes out of the equation if you want. That's all right with me. I mean, I'm not going to tell you what to believe or not believe. I'm going to tell you what, based upon my experience, you know, I have found reasonable given the evidence that I've assessed. That doesn't mean that, you know, my views are infallible. I mean, in science, we're always open to new hypotheses and new evidence. So, you know, I'm willing to revise my views if I have a good reason to do that.
Well, yeah, I understand that. Of course, it's not just about Scott. And I know we're not talking about, say, the Pentagon or Shanksville at the moment, but when you look across the board at the eyewitnesses from New York through to Shanksville through to the Pentagon, there really is no consistency at all, and I know that physical evidence trumps eyewitnesses.
Oh,
eyewitnesses.
I think 3 shows going through the witnesses, the 80 witnesses or so at the Pentagon with Mike Sparks, and they're practically all completely preposterous witnesses. They're either too vague or they weren't in a position to see, or what they claimed to have seen wasn't present when they claimed to have seen it and all that. I supervised recruit training in San Diego for a year. I had 300 DIs and 15 drill instructors and 300 recruits under my command. And as I've observed on some of my shows, I could have had 300 recruits swear on their mother's grave that they saw Bruce Wayne drive the Batmobile into the Pentagon. I mean, you know, some of these witness reports are just completely ludicrous. There are a few that are very reasonable. The Citizens Investigative Team, of course, came across, you know, about a dozen or so that reported seeing a plane approach the Pentagon north of the Citgo station, which is consistent with the black box data that the National Transportation Safety Board gave to pilots, which when they studied corresponded to a completely different approach and trajectory. A due east, 300 feet in the air, too high to hit a lamppost, 1 second from the building that's 100 feet too high, swerves over the building. That's what comes out of the data given by the NTSB to pilots. And what happened was, you know, completely inconsistent with the acute northeast trajectory of this plane flying 500 miles an hour, barely skimming the ground and hitting all these lampposts, which I've already explained is aerodynamically and physically impossible. So CIT went out and tracked down about a dozen witnesses. They noticed there was a Citgo gas station in between the two trajectories. So if they saw the plane coming north of the Citgo, it confirmed the NTSB data trajectory of south and the official trajectory. And all the witnesses confirmed the NTSB trajectory, the 300 feet in the air too high to hit any lamppost. I think that's very good work. Now, they all seem to think that the plane had crashed into the building because of the explosions that took place, but it actually flew over the building. There's no evidence of any Boeing 757 having hit the building. There's no massive pile of debris. There's chain link fence. There are unbroken windows. There are two enormous spools of cable. There are two cars. No massive pile of aluminum debris. No wings. No seats. No body. No tail. Not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, were recovered from the Pentagon. We have April Gallup, a civilian employee who walked out of the building through the hole allegedly made by the plane and saw no parts of any plane. We have Jamie McIntyre giving an interview for CNN where the anchor asks him about the plane that hit there, and he says, well, you might think a plane, but from his close-up inspection, there's no evidence, no indication of any big plane having it anywhere near the Pentagon. And then we have General Albert Stubblebine, who used to be in charge of all U.S. military photographic intelligence, giving an interview with a reporter in Germany and saying how he had studied all the photographs carefully, and he was confident no plane had hit the building because there was no indication of any plane, wings of any plane on the building. Now, the walls of the Pentagon are 2 feet thick. There's a foot of concrete and then 8 inches of brick and 4 inches of limestone, which is a very soft, porous stone. If a plane had hit there, there would have been an impact of the wings. I think Stubblebine's observation was right. No plane at the Pentagon. So we got a bunch of witnesses claiming they saw the plane at the building, but they're clearly testifying falsely. There's no doubt about it. We got this trucker buddy of the friend of mine who actually saw the plane fly toward the building and then swerve over. He is an honest guy. That's consistent with all the rest of the data. I don't take the truth of any witness at face value. It's got to cohere with all the evidence.
Yeah, I know. What I'm saying with Scott Forbes is there's no real evidence because we have multiple sources. There's no proof of any power down. In fact, there's proof to the contrary because we have tickets. People who visited the observation.
I'd be astonished if he were if he were not correct about the power down. I mean, you know, that's interesting. And I note it. That you have this reservation. I'd be very surprised, however, if that were true. I mean, I'm not saying you're necessarily wrong. I'd be just be surprised if there had been no power down.
Maybe we should make an agreement.
It's not the only source. I've heard other reports of a power down having occurred there. But I certainly don't think it was when they snuck in like a bunch of rats to stash all the, you know, these mini nukes are just like the size of a grapefruit or even smaller. I mean, you know, stashing them and all that would not have been a big problem. Plus, there was this elevator renovation being done by Ace Elevator Company. It was supposed to be the biggest elevator renovation in history. Well, that was a great way to have a cover to conceal the implanting of these mini or micro nukes.
So, do you think what we saw?
Well, that's very interesting that because this is on the one hand, he doesn't believe it's when they snuck in like a bunch of rats, but on the other hand, he seems to say things that contradict that. And in fact, that's certainly the rhetoric that we've heard a lot in Loose Change and other films, you know, that dealt with this sort of power down. And so, I mean, we can't take that much further than that, but it's interesting because he says that, you know, basically, all the Pentagon witnesses and Shanksville witnesses are total liars, bar one or two of them, perhaps, just because they don't have any obvious flaws in their account. However, that doesn't mean you can take them at face value just because they don't have any flaws in their account, certainly when there's so many other liars. But, you know, we have to take the Pentagon witnesses, you know, as being we have to take the World Trade Center victim, the witnesses rather, as being bona fide, despite the fact that the Pentagon and Shanksville witnesses are total liars. I was more than a little mystified, you know, to say the least, because, you know, how can there be such a parallel, such a lack of a parallel? I mean, for what it's worth, Jim, you know, I went to elementary, secondary, and high school for 15 years consecutively, far more recently than you did, and I have an excellent barometer as well when someone isn't being truthful with me. And I have to say that the Scott Forbes show was one of the most painful shows I've listened to on his archive, because on one occasion in particular, Scott was describing the destruction of the World Trade Center, and he kept referring to the fact he heard it before he saw it. And then he says, which I suppose is some sort of attempt at inferring pre-demolition explosives, But anyway, he kept saying he felt it was because the speed of sound, quote, was faster than the speed of light. And thankfully, Fetzer corrected him, but he had to do so three times. And Scott was extremely adamant about this fact. And, I mean, myself, I mean, I knew by age six that light traveled faster than sound. I mean, what grown man hasn't seen thunder or lightning, you know, doesn't know that. I mean, I'm not trying to be condescending, but yeah, he did make himself sound so stupid that he basically discredited everything he said from that point on for a lot of people hearing that. I mean, you know, it just seemed like something that was put in there, like, to just make a mockery of himself. And it was most bizarre to listen to. Right, we're going to actually take a first break now, but we'll get into this issue a little more when we get back. So don't go anywhere. You've got James Sloan from Dose of Reality Radio. And we will be right back. Welcome back to Dose of Reality. You are here with James Sloan tonight. Now, the audio clip we just heard before the break is very interesting. You know, Jim is very defensive of Scott, which, you know, I can understand that, though. I mean, I have to say that we've had guests on this show, Brian particularly, who, you know, we have challenged. I mean, just because we had them on our show doesn't mean we take them at face value, you know. Jim included, I have to say. And so it seems strange that he seems unwilling to sort of get into this account. I mean, he kind of gives you a little way and says, well, you know, if I have reason to believe, you know, I'll go and check it. And as we hear later on, he does no such thing. I mean, I don't know. You can't, I'm not saying you can read anything into it. It's just that, you know, it just seems rather bizarre. You know, particularly he lambasts me for challenging Scott's account of a power down. But my information was solid. And this is a key point of the whole thing. Firstly, if the tower was powered down for even just 48 hours, you know, 2 days, that's 100,000 tourists and New Yorkers who would not have been able to visit the top of the world observation deck viewing platform. You know, 50,000 people visited this daily. It was a big moneymaker, along, of course, with the Windows on the World restaurant on the other side, on the North Tower, in the indoor viewing platform. At least on that tower, I assume both towers had an indoor viewing platform up the top, but certainly the South did. It's a very valid point, which is supported by the existence online of tickets of people who did, in fact, visit over that weekend, that 100,000 people, you know, who would have been turned away from the World Trade Center just days before 9/11, would have aroused massive suspicion. I mean, how would you keep those people quiet? You know, wouldn't we have heard from some of them? You know, some of them at least would have read conspiracies challenging the official story of 9/11. And if they were inclined to believe that explosives may have been used to bring the towers down, I mean, wouldn't a big green light go off in the head? Holy shit, what, you know, holy shit, as the 9/11 people like to say in the videos. You know, we were at the World Trade Center and they turned us away. There was a big power down, you know, we couldn't go up to the viewing platform. You know, and similarly, everybody in the North Tower who went to dinner that night, who was at work that weekend, would have noticed half the building wasn't lit up. You know, there would be hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, I know obviously we presented evidence to the effect that the towers were massively under-occupied compared to what we've been told. But certainly, these viewing platforms were definitely, there are thousands of home videos of people visiting the World Trade Center's observation deck. I mean, that was, and the Windows on the World, that was undoubtedly there. You know, what was between the lobby and there, you know, and how occupied it was is a different matter entirely. But certainly, you know, the highest outdoor viewing platform in New York City, I don't know about the United States. I know the Sears Tower is taller. I don't know exactly what outdoor viewing platform they have, but certainly in that part of the States, you know, the biggest, it was a massive moneymaker. You know, so how on earth would you keep all those people quiet? You know, they would be mostly tourists, but there would be a lot of New Yorkers too. And you would hear these stories. Absolutely you would. And, you know, Jim, you know, he fails to even acknowledge this point when I bring it up. I guess probably if I could be critical of perhaps of myself and perhaps Brian in that show, I think we perhaps were guilty of asking Jim perhaps maybe too many double-barrel questions where he could perhaps just ignore or forget to answer the first, or, you know, and perhaps that's not the best way to conduct these interviews. But in saying that, you know, we had a lot of questions, and he could have done his best to answer them. And secondly, he gets really mad at me and Brian for, quote-unquote, not knowing the dates of the Scott Forbes affair. But he himself admits he doesn't even know the exact dates, and then self-promotes and directs us to his archives of his show, which I can understand, but you know, he underestimates us because I've known the exact dates for years. I've heard this account many, many times, and indeed his own podcast confirms that it started a Friday afternoon and went through to at least a Sunday morning. You know, he literally worked overtime on Sunday and Monday to get the computer systems back up and running, hence why he took Tuesday, September 11th off in the first place and didn't die in the building. In any case, the Friday the 7th start time is the key factor because we have Ryan Adams' music video, New York, New York. The video even says itself was shot on Friday the 7th of September. I have no reason to doubt the validity of that. I don't see any reason why they would lie about such a thing. And the music video was shot over the course of this day and into the night. And it clearly shows both towers of the World Trade Center lit up like a Christmas tree. There was no power down in Tower 2, because all the lights would be out in the top half of the building. Jim was very uninterested in this, however, and clearly did not follow it up, because nearly 3 months later, on a second show, he again attacked Brian vehemently for not knowing the dates. The same rhetoric, almost word for word. Again, for your luxury, we will hear an excerpt from the December interview on Jim's network. And this is Jim Fetzer right now to Brian Staveley.
Gravitate towards something like you're describing, but I frankly just don't have any reason to doubt what Scott Froese is saying.
No, because Jim, like with Scott Forbes, the guy you were just talking about, and you say he appears to be credible, he also talks about a power down the night before or whatever, and there was actually a music video that was shot on the roof of the World Trade Center on the day before, and it shows clearly that there wasn't a power down. So,
oh, no, come on. No, this is a couple days. This is like Friday, Saturday. He was working over the weekend. I'm sorry, Brian, I just think you're putting things together the wrong way. I don't know what more to tell you. This guy is very credible. There were other reports about a power down. That is not mythology, and I think you're just wrong. I suggest...
You agree that the Pentagon crash site was fake, right? We agreed on that?
Sure.
Okay, and there were witnesses to that, supposedly. So how come
No.
Brian,
I spent 3 hours going through the witnesses at the Pentagon with Mike Sparks. There were about 80 of them. And we went through each one of them, okay? And they either weren't in the position they claimed or they just weren't credible, okay? And we know what happened, and there was no evidence of a crash there and all that. Hey, we even know in New York that this can't be a real plane. You agree with that? It looks to me as though those cutouts, which appeared after the plane had already gone into the building, you know, that's very interesting because, in other words, the causal process that is supposed to be creating the cutout isn't taking place at the time it's supposed to be creating the cutout, but only shows up later. The plane's already in the building before the cutout appears. It only appears after all the smoke is cleared. So we see the plane half in and half out of the building. I mean, it's preposterous, and I know you agree with that. And it's just
about... I agree with that.
Yeah.
But if it's a hologram also, all the angles from all the videos should be the same or relatively close to the same. There will be different perspectives that people have. And there's some that are clearly very contradictory to each other.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong, Brian. With a hologram, you're going to get this from some angles. You may not be able to see it at all. And we have videos that show the left wing is missing. Now, how can that be the case? You know, I mean, obviously it means it's not a real plane. But the whole left wing is missing.
It's CGI or a hologram. That could be the case in either. I mean, couldn't it?
Listen,
we have a picture of that missing wing.
I have submitted from the beginning that the key differentiating feature between these three different accounts of how it was faked is whether or not there were any witnesses. I agree with that. And I have had people call up and just be so adamant about how they not only saw the plane, but they heard the plane, and how could that have been faked? And that's where Richard Hall, I think, has answered the question. It can be the case that they were hearing the real sound of a real plane. It just wasn't the plane that they thought the sound was coming from, but the plane that was projecting the image. I say, everybody, go online, look for this Richard Hall study. It's called... 3D radar study of Flight 175, and look at it, because I don't go very far. Or they focus on Building 7 and the Twin Towers, which is fine as far as it goes, but they don't even talk about how it was actually done. They just show that it wasn't a collapse. And that's all well and good, but that's like baby steps, you know, like that's like the freshman course. I'm more interested in the graduate seminar, how all this was done, who was responsible and why, which is what we did at the Vancouver hearing. So, you know, I'm not
hey,
all
Jim,
that.
Here's an interesting point, right? like you messaged me on Facebook earlier, and that's a good platform to, you know, try and get information out. I know you use it. I use it. That's how I've met a lot of people in this game. That's, I'm sure you have too. It's been, you know, has its good things and its bad things. But you see people post all kinds of crazy crap all day. I mean, people will post real news stories, you know, real stuff. People will post pictures of kittens. People will post joke Hallmark cards. People will post videos of their kids at soccer games. How come every 9/11 anniversary, our news feed isn't flooded with all these families posting videos of their children or their husbands that died in the towers at the World Trade Center? Even stupid videos like they have, you know, just a video of them, and, you know, it doesn't have to be at an airport or anything or at work. I mean,
you notice in the first excerpt of the audio, we called them Scott Frauds. I don't know whether that was some sort of Freudian slip or whether it was just a mistake. I tend to think the second. I think he said he was under some sleep deprivation, that show we did. But I think it's a perfectly adept name for him, to tell you the truth. And but Jim did make an excellent point there about the cutouts and how they actually appear after the impact and the explosion, and they don't appear as it's happening. And that was certainly one of the better points of the night. You know, as was Brian's point there about how these victims in the towers, we don't see videos of them and all sorts of things every year, tribute pages on Facebook and such like. But it's actually time for our second break tonight, but don't go anywhere. We'll play a bit of audio and then we'll analyze some of these things further after the break. You're with James Sloan on Dose of Reality, and we'll be back soon.
But they could have been. They could have been in the hopper prior to 9/11 and just said, okay, here's footage of what's going on here in the present day of some, but what actually they're presenting to you is something that had been created and generated, you know, no telling how long prior.
Hollywood movie split up to look like a newscast.
Got downtown Manhattan on a bright, clear, sunny day. You know, maybe one of the, this is speculation, but maybe one of the reasons why they picked a totally cloudless day is you don't have any, that's less references you can make to real life. You know, you look on television, those clouds are not in the west. I'm looking at right now and they're in the east or what have you. They just eliminated that, but you just have Manhattan on a clear sunny day and all these scenarios taking place. And with the crowds running to the streets, the buildings demolishing could be completely CGI. I mean, look at the film 2012. Look how absolutely realistic that is, and then
you discount witnesses as who claim to have seen what they took to be a real plane.
Well, I mean, you know, another possibility. You know, I wasn't there, so I don't know. Is that, you know, could there have been a holograph or something to that effect to, in other words, you have this separate presentation that's for, you know, anybody that would be actually physically there to witness. And then you have a rendered presentation that's vetted prior that doesn't have anything telltale in it that's going to give it away.
It's a long road when you're on your own, and it hurts when they tear your dreams apart. And every new town just seems to bring you down, trying to find peace of mind and break your heart. Could use a
Tell me, what do you do to survive when they draw first blood? That's just the start of it. Day and night, you gotta fight to keep alive. It's a
truth movement, or the, God, I hate that term, but the road that we all walk is certainly a lonely one at times. Welcome back to Dose of Reality. You're here with James Sloan. So, Jim clearly didn't do his homework after the first show with Brian and Justin, and it's a shame in many ways because he seems rather set in his ways. All the same, time surmising we could be right, but never accepting our challenges. And in fact, before the break, just before we move on, I think Chris Kendall, a regular contributor here, made an excellent point that Jim makes it again in the second show that it is possible. I mean, I don't think it's particularly probable, but it is possible that they could have used a hologram that day in New York, and what they showed us on the television was in fact CGI. It's not particularly likely, but at the end of the day, none of us were actually there. We don't know what they did or didn't do for those witnesses. And as was said, this is part of the 5-10% of 9/11 that they're hiding and that we will never, ever know. And back to the Scott Forbes thing, Jim added that there have been other accounts of a power down, but never actually provides the proof, despite 3 months between the interviews. Yes, I've seen little text scrolls on loose change and such movies, news stories and, a few other accounts of power down, but there is not much concrete confirming the story. Not that we can pick up and run with. I mean, these movies are not really to be trusted. They've been thoroughly debunked, in fact. They give you 50% of the truth at the most, but what they give you is just based on a false narrative. I mean, 3,000 deaths and no media complicity. On the whole, though, I must say the second show was very good. I mean, Fetzer was, I think, suffering from sleep deprivation the first time around. It was around 9/11, so he was doing a lot of shows and a lot of work. And maybe he was shorter with us than what he normally would be, and in fact, he even said that. Basically, he was open to all our research, and we could certainly relate to him about the attacks we have had on each other, the association and subsequent disassociation with various parties over the years in this game. Particularly in the second show, we delved into that. The only other issue we jabbed on, really, were elements of the second plane fakery. Fetzer is a staunch supporter of holography. Of course, our angle is more toward the CGI, at least in terms of what we were shown on television. The two aren't mutually exclusive, though, and Jim actually made that point quite well on the second show. and again, Brian and Jim jabs over much of the issues and the non-issues, but, you know, I have to say, as biased as I might be and as I am, I do feel that Brian came out the stronger both times. I mean, for example, as we're about to hear here, you know, on the first show, Brian actually managed to get Fetzer to concede that some of the videos probably do show differing trajectories, which is not particularly good for his position.
That it was performing feats that no real plane could perform and therefore cannot have been a real plane.
Now, Jim, I have a clip I want to show you real quick, and I'm pretty sure you've probably seen it, but do you still have that webpage open that we were looking at?
Yeah, I do, sure.
Okay, if you scroll down a little bit, we got the two huge pictures. Then we have a third picture, which is from the Jennifer Spell video, where the plane is embedded even farther in the building. Again, the building has very little detail to it, but yeah. I want to actually go down a little bit more. You see the two videos side by side. One is the Herzakhani shot. One is the Herzakhani shot re-edited.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right below the re-edited Herzakhani shot, there's one that says NBC News helicopter.
Right, right.
Now, in the live, we're going to, yeah, why don't you play that and take a look at it? Well, I'll play it right now. We'll just mute the volume a little bit.
Okay.
While you're watching it, if you look in the daytime coverage, you don't see a plane at all. Now, in the nighttime coverage, when the plane's added to it, the background of the Hudson River is completely gone, along with all the boats and everything in the background. Now, how could that be an effect of a hologram as opposed to a CGI video? To me,
well, I know, you know, it's entirely possible. But you know, they use different methods for different purposes and to obfuscate. Certainly, the missing background is incredibly suspicious. I agree with that. There's something very odd going on there. So I agree with that. And you know, whether some of them could have been CGI'd or composited. The question is whether, you know, that I've taken to be basic is using the Herzakhani and the Evan Fairbanks as the basic data. What do we got going on there? And what explanation provides the most adequate analysis? And it seems to be the use of a hologram. But by the way, you know, those cookie cutter cutouts, you got one down here somewhere. Oh, yeah, there's one down here. The Roberto Rabane Corbis around 9:30 a.m. Let's see. Is Edna Cintrone in this?
I do have her somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is very suspicious. I mean, look
at the suspicious because that hole was smoking the whole time, pretty much, wasn't it?
Well, not only that, but I mean, look at the steel that remains. I mean, if the plane had actually had the wings and the, you know, the further you go out on the wing, the more fragile they are. But allegedly, it was cutting through. And, you know, as you have all those steel support columns there on the left, which aren't even ruptured, you don't have any massive pile of debris here. You don't see the tail sticking out. You may remember when the Empire State Building was hit. You could see very obviously that it was a plane. We've had other planes hit buildings, and you typically see a lot of remnants. Here you don't see any remnants. So you got things that are present that shouldn't be present if the plane had, like this, you know, the extensions of the steel hanging down. And then you have the things that are absent that should be present, such as a massive amount of debris. I mean, remember, this thing only had 48 feet to come to a complete screeching halt in that 56/1000th of a second. So we at the Vancouver hearings, one of our speakers, Christopher Holmes, did a close-up study and went through in great detail a photograph very much like this one, although I think it had Edna in it. I'm not quite sure if that's Edna in there or not. But it was very convincing how, you know, this is a fabrication. Now, what Hall, Richard Hall, discovered was that when you have the initial encounter, say, in the North Tower, and since we know something is wrong, how was it done? And there are the three theories, the three alternatives of GCI, video compositing, and hologram. And I'm trying to explain why I believe, in fact, it was done with a hologram and that Richard Hall is the one who's provided the missing link. Because, look, you got this radar data for this plane that's flying 1,400 feet to the right of the image as we see it in these videos. And it's also true for the North Tower hit, by the way. He discovered it's not only true for the South Tower hit, but it's also true for the North Tower hit. And the image in the North Tower hit, of course, looks a whole lot less like a 767 than for the South Tower. But the fact is they both appear to have been done using a projection of a hologram from a plane that itself appears to have been cloaked, but where the noise it was making was, you know, assumed to be the noise of the image that people were seeing. I mean, very clever form of deception.
But what if you're saying, all the videos the same trajectory? Wouldn't all the videos have the same trajectory if they're all filming the same hologram? Why would you have all these different trajectories like this, the so-called dive bomber shot, which we'll show after the videos where it's ascending up?
I think there may be a question there, but they may have, you know, thrown in a few kind of loopy videos too, because, I mean, everything I get from Richard Hall is he found you had the 52 videos that were basically all consistent. He was able to find 27 that were useful enough that he could do the plots of the locations and times for the image. And he found that the NTSB had the same locations, plots of, for times and locations of the image. I think that's pretty stunning. And then it turns out there's...
Well, I mean, this admission is very confusing, because if they didn't put out videos to, I guess you might say, soil the well, I mean... Richard Hall's entire study based off the said videos is kind of moot. I mean, you know, to say that the angles more or less match up is completely ridiculous. There's no such thing. Some of them show the plane ascending, some of them show the plane on a narrow or a flat trajectory, some of the videos show a dive bombing from ridiculous altitudes. You know, in the second interview as well, when Brian suggested, you know, a similar premise in terms of trusting or distrusting, you know, the radar data or the supposed radar data from Richard Hall's study possibly being doctored for the same reason, Jim was very suspicious and very dismissive, as we are about to hear in the following clip.
That's all, Michael. My question is, you know, with all the witnesses that, you know, we're talking about, and never mind, you know, I'm not, without questioning their credibility, okay, never mind that, if the plane was a hologram that was projected from another plane 1,400 feet to the side of it, you don't think any of them would notice the difference in the sound of the flyover at all? They wouldn't notice that it was 1,400, I mean, they're not going to know, hey, that's 1,400 feet away, but they're not going to be able to tell that it's not right overhead? Wouldn't it seem a little fishy to some of them?
No, that's a bad argument, Brian. Look, let's talk about what Richard Hall established, okay? He obtained copies of, I think there might have been as many as 52 videos that have been taken of Flight 175. He studied them to determine if they would, you know, had useful information that would enable him to determine the position and location, the location and times of the image as it was approaching the building, okay? And he found about 27 that were useful for that. So he plotted a graph, you know, of showing where the plane was at the different times. He subsequently discovered that it may have been the NTSB had a similar chart with the similar locations and times that it claimed had been placed based upon radar data. He thought it looked funny because their chart for the radar data didn't look authentic. Now, what subsequently happened is he discovered there was another study that was actually based on radar data that showed a plane approaching the building, but it was 14 feet to the side of the original location. Therefore, he conjectures, and I think he's got to be right, that this plane 1,400 feet to the side, which had to be, you know, have been using some kind of stealth technology, it wasn't visible from the ground, was projecting the image.
What do you mean by that, though? You mean like cloaked, like invisible, like a Klingon vessel? Like, is that what you mean?
Brian, why are you talking about Klingon vessels? I mean, it's common knowledge we have cloaking or, you know, technology that makes planes very difficult to see. You could have just painted it a color that would blend in with the sky that day. The point is, nobody saw this other plane, but it's on the radar data. Now, the radar data, it looks to be authentic for the following reason. If it's fabricated, it's ridiculous because it suggests there's a plane 1,400 feet to the side of where it's supposed to be, which contradicts the government's official account. So the government can't be giving us fabricated radar data, which contradicts its own account.
They could because most people take the official story for what it is, and the people that are looking into something like this, like we are, it's there maybe to throw you down that rabbit trail, you know? That could be a possibility. I wouldn't say that's impossible.
Brian, we're already down the rabbit hole. We already know this video is showing impossible performances by the aircraft. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
So you agree there's some kind of fakery going on. You also agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
You also agree that if it were CGI or video compositing, then there wouldn't be any image or plane for the witnesses to report seeing.
I agree with that, but I don't trust the witnesses that say they saw the plane. That's the
problem. Well, that's okay. You don't trust them. I say they appear to be too many, and I found this one guy who seems to be, Scott Forbes is his name, by the way, Scott Forbes.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to me to be quite credible. Let me also say, by the way, that I also interviewed, I mean, I interviewed all these people on my show at different times, not to all together, but on different occasions. And I also interviewed a fellow named Stephen Brown, who'd actually recently completed a course on holography at Cambridge, who explained that, yes, the technology existed to project such a hologram at the time.
He also says early on that anything the government says about issues of importance can be taken with a grain of salt. And I agree with that. So it seems strange that issues such as the missing $2.3 trillion at the Pentagon, the radar data, and other issues should be taken as gospel. That's purely my own opinion. You know, this is hardly me picking on Jim here, but I simply feel that as he is probably, at least at this point in time, considered the standard on the hologram stance, along with Richard Hall and others, it is important to express a view on this interview. And Fetzer says that Brian's was a bad argument in terms of the cloaked stealth plane. I felt it was actually a very good argument because my personal suspicion, hologram, no hologram, that part of the fakery that day in New York City, which we didn't see or hear on television, they may very well have played the sound of a jet over some sort of loudspeaker system that day in New York City, you know, to create ear witnesses but not eyewitnesses. And they see the image on television, they reconcile with that. That is possible. I mean, there's no evidence to support that. But it is possible. You know, Fetzer's suggestion of a cloaked plane going faster than the hologram is also particularly strange because part of his and a lot of other people's best arguments of no planes at the World Trade Center is that commercial jets, 767s or large planes, cannot go that fast in the first place. Now, he didn't say that the vessel was, quote-unquote, a jumbo jet, but you know, the plane going at that speed, a cloaked plane, and it just, he seems to be majorly contradicting himself in that sense. And just because the technology exists to project a hologram doesn't mean you can do it in the broad daylight. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can do it without the image projecting off other buildings or, I guess, flattening out just before it hits the building and reflecting off the windows and such like. There's a massive difference between projecting a hologram in the middle of the night projecting it in the broad daylight. So my opinion is an equally bad argument about a stealth plane going, you know, and he says that you have to paint it the color of the sky. I think, well, if it's only 1,400 feet away, then that's no good. So I think that's an equally bad argument in my book. Anyway, we're going to actually take a final break here and come back for our final segment after this. So you're listening to Post of Reality Radio with your host Sloan, and we will be right back.
Fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine, get what you want to if you want, as you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? Children play.
Myself, Justin, and Brian are very satisfied with the show. The shows we did with Bits, so we're not suggesting there's anything untoward per se. We just what I'm doing here is merely just critiquing, I guess, is the word. Because after these shows, I feel that if people don't sort of, people often wonder things. They have questions about certain key areas of conjecture, and I feel it's important to clear those up. I mean, I can't speak for Brian, I can't speak for Justin, I can only speak for myself, but we've discussed these things privately, and I think we pretty much agree on most of these things. So anyway, I want you to listen closely to this piece of audio, and we'll talk about it after.
Ridiculous. I have another question about the hologram theory of yours, though, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
If they did use a hologram, and let's just say that's totally feasible, and they could do that technology, like you said, what the hell started the fires in the building, and who started them?
They had previously positioned. I mean, this is special effects. This is Hollywood stuff, Brian.
Do you think when Rambo attacks that North Vietnamese prison camp and there are explosions going on all over the place and blood is spewing off of all the North Vietnamese guards and all that stuff that he's actually killing all those people? I mean, you know.
No, I don't.
Well, the screen, you know, they'd have a hard time recruiting actors, and the Screen Actors Guild wouldn't stand for it. I mean, you know, this is just special effects stuff. They had previously positioned explosives to set off when the images, you know, were in the right place. I mean, the mere fact that the planes could go all the way into the buildings before they explode is a sure sign that this is fraudulent, that this is fake. The fuel's in the wings, it would have exploded as they were entering or crushing up against the building. Most of it would have been external, not internal. Especially when you're talking about an angle of, you know, intersecting with eight different floors in the south tower and seven in the north.
Okay, so we definitely disagree on you know, how the fakery was pulled off as far as the CGI versus the hologram. We agree.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but I found Jim to be somewhat condescending on that occasion. The Rambo point was extremely lost on me. I mean, I suspect I know what he was trying to say. But Brian had an excellent point here that he didn't get a chance to get into, and I think it really ties into this whole no plane thing and why it's such a controversial issue in terms of the official story. And I got into this quite a bit in a blog that I recently wrote, which you can find on the Real News website. But basically, the issue here is that for the plane, with this hologram argument, you know, the CGI argument answers everything, in my opinion, because all of the television footage from the point of the impact onwards is fake. So that means that the smoke is fake, the fires are fake, the jumpers are fake, and indeed the eventual demise of the buildings is in fact fake. Now, where Jim Fitz's hologram argument, I think, falls short is that what happens after this hologram impacts, we're to assume that all the television footage is in fact real after that point. Now, the point Brian made, and I think he made it quite astutely, is that how do you have this fire and the smoke? Because, you know, I guess Jim's argument was that there were pre-positioned explosives that blew a hole in the side of the tower, a cookie cutter shaped cutout of a plane. But what about the fire? I mean, do shape charges really start a fire afterwards? And furthermore, a fire that would burn the color of black, you know, jet fuel, black smoke. There are videos that actually show differing coloring smoke at the same time, and that's a large part of the fakery argument. But Jim's argument is the television footage is assumed to be real. This two-hour window after the first impact and between the second collapse, almost a two-hour time window, what is creating these fires and what is sustaining them? You know, it would seem rather risky. I mean, the fires could die out, and then it would be very embarrassing for the powers that be to try and explain what caused these buildings to come down, because the pseudo argument of an aircraft crash and or fire bringing the tower down would be literally reduced to rubble, the argument. And I guess you could kind of formulate an argument, though, in a sense that, well, that's why the South Tower came down first, even though it was hit second, apart from just to confuse people, was also because of the fact that actually the fires had died out and they had to bring the tower down, otherwise it would be very embarrassing. And that ties into, you know, the firemen supposedly getting to the impact zone and extinguishing the fires, or indeed saying they were minimal or non-existent. So, you know, but that all ties together. We didn't get a chance to discuss the firemen and the fire department and their role in the fakery. But it is a very important argument, because if you have a fully occupied tower, you can't have people up there starting fires. And that's the key. And as for the jumpers, well, what is making those people jump? I mean, and what is trapping them up there? Because if a hologram hit the building, then the whole argument for the jumpers is that they couldn't get down, they couldn't get through the impact zone because there was all this plane debris there that was stopping them from getting through. So what? How are those people stuck up there? If no plane hit the building, they shouldn't be stuck there. They should be able to evacuate down, even if shape charges did blow a hole in the side of the building. I mean, there are a myriad of things wrong with the jumpers that we've discussed in other shows that prove that they're fake. I mean, this is not something that I necessarily need to get into here, but you know, if you have people up there jumping, how do you have people up there starting and maintaining fires, and they will be subject to the same conditions that would be making the other people jump, whatever those conditions were? So to create and sustain those fires, you have a big problem, in my opinion. And you know, no one put themselves out there. It would be too dangerous a position, and those people would probably die in the building, you know, which is contrary to our view on what happened on 9/11. I accept that he might not accept that nobody died, and that's fine. That's his position. We can't really prove that. It's just our surmise. You know, there's a difference between knowing something in your mind and being able to prove it. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned with 9/11. But I guess it just ties into the hologram theory and why it doesn't actually go far enough to explain what happened after the impact and between the collapses, because there's a lot that happened in that time window. And, you know, the fires, or indeed the smoke being the same color as the jet fuel. And it ties into the hollow towers, and the towers being, if not hollow, then massively under-occupied, which is another issue that ties into it. And, indeed, if the towers were not occupied in that zone, it would make it very easy to set up those special effects and maintain them, because there's nobody there to see it. There's nobody there to stop it. But you wouldn't necessarily need to do that if the television footage is fake. So I think it's a very, very important point that Brian made, and it's a point that Jim seemed to dismiss, you know, far too easily. But nevertheless, I mean, I think it's a very important point, because people always talk about the hologram or the plane being fake and then the building collapsing or being demolished, but there is a hell of a lot that happened in between that time window. And that is where the hologram theory falls a little short, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't explosive devices that can't fake a fire and all the rest of it, but it seems rather risky, particularly if the fire died out, because you've got nobody up there to reignite it. You've got no way of, you know, and if the fire dies out just a minute before you bring the building down, then your whole story about a fire that burns as hot as it did from start to finish and causes the building to collapse, etc., as if that wasn't ridiculous enough, it's totally extinguished. Excuse the pun, because so I think that's a very important point as to how it would be extremely risky to show television footage, you know, after a hologram sort of plane crash, you know, because there's far too many things that I think could go wrong after that point. And if you take the official story or at face value, or the media footage at least, there were people up there, there were jumpers, there were all these people, and they couldn't get down. And why couldn't those people get down again if no plane crashed into the building? Why would they be trapped there? Because there's no plane debris. They could just walk down like they could before. So there's definitely something fishy going on there, and it was a very valid point. But for moving on, for our final piece of audio, I'm actually going to play a clip, and this time I'm going to praise Fetzer, because he probably deserves it, and because he made one of the best points, I think, in the entire show. And we're going to hear the audio of that clip, in which Fetzer goes into detail about, in particular, some of the fakery in New York that we can all agree on.
Out of the clothes, they've just been hit with an airplane, you know what I mean? And I think they did use some, you know, I do think it was total CGI on TV, but there was some form of physical fakery for people that would be in New York, you know, as far as maybe smoke in the building, or did they blow a real hole in the building? I don't know that, you know, but...
Well, you know, there are a couple of alleged plane parts that are clearly fake. The engine at Church and Murray, for example, appears to have been planted there by the FBI, Jack White, who died recently, a wonderful guy, great researcher, discovered Fox News footage showing a white van there and persons in FBI vests unloading something heavy. It was found underneath a steel scaffolding
and the sidewalk was undamaged, whereas if something that massive had hit at high velocity, it would have shattered the sidewalk. No signs of that. And it wasn't even an engine component from a 767. So how bad is that, you know?
I agree. I totally agree. The engine on the street story is bullcrap. I mean, they're going to say this thing went through the towers, but it, you know, all the steel and the concrete and the trusses and the floors and everything came out the other side, and it doesn't even leave a dent in the street. I mean, it's just sitting on the street. Like, you'd think there'd be this massive pothole from this huge titanium engine, you know, flying down. I agree with that. But
So yes, definitely, probably one of the most astute points that anyone made on the show. It definitely belonged to Jim, or either show, in fact. And it was that point, and anyone who's listened to our archives before knows this is probably my biggest pet point on 9/11 that I go on about. But it is a huge key for the 9/11 issue, and people who say, "Oh, what about the thousands of people that saw the planes?" Because, well, then there should be thousands of people that saw this jet engine crash into the street. In fact, there should have been people taken out by it. I mean, there should have been people killed by it. I mean, it would have been this massive side story, if you will, on 9/11. You know, it would have been, you know, there would have been, like, the plane impacts, the towers coming down, Building 7, and then there would have been this engine crashing into the street. There are no air witnesses to it. There are no eyewitnesses to it. In fact, all the cameras that film the impact 5 or 6 seconds after the impact, we should have heard the sound of an engine crashing into the pavement. It should have been a massive deal. In fact, in all probability, considering the landscape of New York City, it would have crashed into a building first. But certainly, if you drop a jet engine, and it's quite amusing actually, because the official story is that this jet engine sliced through the steel, you know, along with the rest of the plane, sliced through the column, sliced through the floor, sliced through the concrete, which extended all the way from one side to the other, 200 feet. I might add. Then once it's done all of that, it detaches from the fuselage somehow, pierces again another hole through the other side of the building, including the steel and the aluminium exterior, the cladding. Not to mention the windows. Don't underrate those windows. The safety glass used on those towers would have been extremely thick, and would have been very hard to penetrate. Which is another story that kind of debunks the jumpers. I don't think they would be able to break those windows, at least not in their entirety, clean out of the frame with any office equipment. You know, those it would have been like a spider's web, the glass. You know, those people would have been getting cut up pretty badly if they had been hanging out the windows as shown to be in the pictures and videos. They would have been bleeding, actually, which you don't see any of that. So they also wouldn't be dressed in their winter's best either. They would be, you know, probably shirtless and trying to put a wet cloth over their mouth or something to survive this high-rise fire, which you don't see any of. The Towering Inferno is a great movie, actually. It shows what people trapped under a fire would really do and what the jumpers didn't do. But just back to the engine, it's a key issue because after it slices through all of that stuff, it travels no less than 500 meters, and perhaps as many as 600 or 700 when you consider the original entry in the other side, as the building is 200 feet wide. It travels 500 meters in an arc. So after it's done all of that, you would think if it could even do that, which it can't, its momentum would be halted. But it travels a further 500 meters to land on the corner of Church Street, Church and Murray, and doesn't even dent the pavement. I mean, it sliced through all of this concrete and all of this steel up there, but when it came to the pavement and the sidewalk and the scaffolding, it couldn't make a dent in that. So, you know, somewhat of an improbability, an impossibility, in fact. And then, you know, you see there's no even hole on the other side of the building where the engine would have had to have come out. And it was wider than a window frame, so it would have had to have sliced through at least some steel and some glass, too. So that story is ridiculous, and it's the most ridiculous example of fakery on 9/11. I tend to think the video was just faked. I mean, the video of the engine in the street was just faked. I don't think they really went there and planted an engine. I think that's too risky. It was 20 minutes after the first impact also, so I mean, there would have been thousands of people on the street if the official story is to be true. How could they plant that with thousands of people there? It wouldn't be particularly likely when they could just fake the footage. But it certainly is the most important point when you talk about the fakery, because it's something that's very overlooked, and the powers that be really did a very shitty job on it. I think they probably should have just left it be, just not bothered with the engine part, because you know, we're the thousands of witnesses to go along with it. And yeah, it's, you can't have it both ways. I always say to people, you can't have it both ways. If there's thousands of people on the street that would have to be lying about seeing the aircraft impact, then we should also have thousands of witnesses to this jet engine. And it's funny how everybody felt so compelled in Manhattan that day to whip out their camera and film a very boring sight, you know, the World Trade Center smoking. But nobody in the street felt compelled to whip out their cameras and film this jet engine lying in the street. You know, it should have been a massive deal. We should have had people take out their cameras and say, oh my God, I almost just got taken out by this jet engine. You know, that person over there is dead from getting... You know, we should have seen that, and we didn't see any of that. So there must have been some paranormal activity going on. People, you know, they're so compelled to whip their cameras out in one instance, but totally unmotivated to do so in another and quite more exciting incidents, I must say. But, yeah, so, and I think that, you know, all in all, I mean, I think the interviews were a success, and much common ground was found between Jim and ourselves. I think much more ground than I anticipated would be found, given that I was familiar with Jim for a number of years, and he has changed his views on a number of issues, that, as we all have, as I said earlier. And so I hadn't kept up with him, so I was very pleased that he was more or less 90% in agreement with what we were talking about. As far as the wider issues are concerned, I mean, the 10% that we disagree on is a very big 10%, and it's a much bigger 10% than the 90% we do agree on. But nevertheless, there was some fun banter there, and there seemed to be a lot of respect gained between the two parties, which was nice to see. And I think that, you know, that pretty much wraps up what I want to get into for the show today. You know, it's just I think it's important for posterity to just review these things rather than, say, leaving it in the archive. And if there was a point that perhaps maybe people felt we did or didn't agree on and they didn't know, or myself even, just to clear things up a little, you know, because, you know, otherwise people tend to think that you may be in agreement with something that you're not just because you didn't challenge it. And, well, because when you're doing live radio, it's very difficult, particularly when you're asking double and triple barrel questions. Sometimes there's points that you just don't get to, and then people think, oh, you must have agreed with him when he said that. That's a bit strange. So it's important to clear these things up, I feel. But anyway, so that pretty much wraps up what I wanted to get into today. But it's been a pleasure hosting the show. And, you know, it's something a little different doing these solo shows, but I do enjoy it. It gives a chance to prepare and really nut down what you want to talk about. It's a nice change, I think. So, but anyway, this is pretty much it. So you've been with James Sloan, A Dose of Reality Radio. Have a very good day, and we'll see you before long.
Have you seen the old man in the closed-down market, kicking up the paper with his worn-out shoes? In his eyes you see no pride, and held loosely at his side, yesterday's paper telling yesterday's news. So how can you tell me you're lonely, and say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London, show you something to make you change your mind. Have you seen the old girl who walks the streets of London, dirt in her hair and her clothes in rags? She's no time for talking, she just keeps right on walking, carrying her home in two carrier bags. So how
How can you tell me you're lonely and say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London, show you something to make you change your mind. In the all-night cafe at 11:15, same old man sitting there on his own, looking at the world over the rim of his teacup. Each tea lasts an hour and he wanders home alone. So how can you tell me that you're lonely and you say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind. Have you seen the old man outside the seaman's mission? Memory fading with metal ribbons that he wears. And in our winter city, the rain cries a little pity for one more forgotten hero and a world that doesn't care. So how can you tell you're lonely and you say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind.
I'm pretty pleased about that.
So how can you tell me that you're lonely and you say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something.